Goodness, but here comes our guest pastor now. Everybody, welcome, Spider-Man.
Hello, everyone. Can you all hear me? Hello, everyone. I know you weren't expecting to see me today. That I'm a close friend of Pastor Tracy's, and she said she needed me, and my spidey senses were tingling, that a guest preacher was needed, so here I am. I understand this morning you heard from the book of Daniel, the spookiest passage in the entire Bible, with the floating hand that comes out and starts writing on the wall, and that very night someone dies. Spooky, spooky. So my understanding is that this occurs a few generations after King Nebuchadnezzar. Who is here has heard of King Nebuchadnezzar? Yeah, he's a pretty familiar character in the Bible. King Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon when Babylon sacked and exiled southern Israel. He wasn't the first king to do that. The Assyrians had done it several hundred years prior. And at this point, we're talking about one of his grandsons, Balthazar. And King Nebuchadnezzar, what you need to understand about him and about his grandson was that they were the most powerful rulers on the planet at that point. They had enormous amounts of power. They had conquered the entire civilized world, pretty much. They had done it through violent means, through forced population displacement and population control. And at this point, they had more money, more power, more army, and more land than anybody else. It was power unchecked. And Balthazar has just come into this. He didn't earn it. He didn't fight for it. He was just born into it. And so he's sitting around one night with his friends, with his fellow leaders who are under him, and they're having a big old feast. They're having a big old party. And they've been eating a lot, and they've been drinking a lot. And all of a sudden, at a certain point, he decides he wants to show off. And he can do this in a number of ways. But what he decides to do is he decides to send someone to go get the sacred vessels that were taken out of the temple in Jerusalem when they sacked it and use them to serve at his dinner party. Can you imagine if someone came in here and stole all of the communion vessels and then went and used them to serve up McDonald's at the local McDonald's? It's a huge slight. It's a huge insult. It's a huge exploitation of the people that he had conquered and that he was now entrusted to care for. And what's interesting about this passage is that it's not the first time that we see something like this. In fact, we see it twice before we get to this point. And what have I told you? Do you remember what I've told you when you see the same thing happen three times in the Bible? Pay attention. Pay attention. The author's trying to tell you something. So the first time we see this happen is earlier in the book of Daniel with Nebuchadnezzar himself, where he has a dream about a gigantic statue. But the statue is made out of different materials. It's made out of gold on the top, silver below, bronze in the middle, and the bottom is iron mixed with clay. And he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know how to interpret this dream that he's had. So he calls on Daniel, who has the gift of interpretation. And Daniel tells him that this means that the kingdom of Babylon will fall, that the gold represents really powerful, good leadership. And then after that, pretty good but not great leadership. That's the silver. Then some pretty poor leadership in bronze. And then the final leadership will be terrible leadership. Bronze or iron mixed with clay don't mix. It makes things brittle and it makes things break. And the kingdom will be divided. That's the first dream. So he's prophesying the end of Babylon. The second time it happens, Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. And Daniel interprets it to mean that Nebuchadnezzar is going to spend some time being a wild animal because he's become too prideful. And so he needs to learn humility. And so he does. He goes off and he spends some time on all fours eating grass in field for a few months before he can learn how to be a humble leader. And then we get to some time past after that where we have Belshazzar, and he's having this dinner party, and he decides to pull out all these vessels, and everybody's eating off of them, probably eating non-kosher foods that would absolutely make them unclean. And all of a sudden, this hand comes out of the wall and starts writing on the wall these strange words. Mene, mene, tekel, parson. And what's interesting about them is that there's a double word play going on here. They both sound like another word, and they sound like a second word as well. Mene sounds like the word mina, which was a form of money. It was large. It was heavy, and it was generally made out of gold or gold material. Tekel sounds like shekel. We all heard of shekel. Shekel is a 60th of a mina, and it's used to weigh things. It was often put on scales to weigh things. And then you have the parson, the peres, which sounds like parson, which is a half of a shekel, and it generally was two coins hooked together, two pieces hooked together. And so when you see these words, not only do they sound like money, but they also sound like words that sound like count, weight, and divided. And so Daniel interprets this for them, that the kingdom has been weighed and measured and divided, but it also sounds a lot like that statue that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about, the gold, the silver, and then the two materials that were divided. And so we see that his original dream, the oracle, if you will, is now coming to pass with Belshazzar. And so this story is spooky. It's about a spooky hand writing on a spooky wall with spooky words at a very strange party. And at the same time, it's a powerful passage about leadership and about what happens to leadership when there is power that is unchecked. And we see this throughout the Bible. We see it with Nebuchadnezzar, who started out doing okay. He was a powerful leader. He was a pretty good leader, but he was not humble enough. He did not have humility. And as he became more and more powerful, he stopped giving glory to God about this, and he started taking credit for himself. And that was his downfall. That was his downfall. And he did a lot of bad things. He conquered an enormous number of lands, and he did not train up his sons underneath him to be able to be good, responsible leaders. And when we look at the example of, for example, David. David came to power. He was anointed. He was chosen and anointed. Remember that? He was chosen out of seven brothers. He was the only one that was chosen, and he was anointed by the prophet Samuel. But we all know what happened when David had too much power. He started behaving irresponsibly. He started doing things that were inappropriate. He started using his power to take advantage of people who couldn't fight back. And he did some unfortunate things. They still say he was a good ruler, but not in that way. And we have the example of Elisha. And sometimes when I was learning about Elisha and Elijah, I used to get them mixed up. I used to think they were the same person, but they were two different people. Elijah was a very powerful prophet, and Elisha followed after him. And he came to his power in a very interesting way. He earned it. He fought for it. He followed Elijah around as his servant and as his helper, and he learned from him. He watched everything that he did. He learned from him. He studied under him. He did what he could to mimic what he was doing. And when Elijah's time was near to the end of his life, and Elisha had spent many years following him, Elisha asked very respectfully, "When you go, please let your spirit fall on me so that I might continue your work." And it did. And he did continue his work. And he used his work to help widows, to help orphans, to help the hungry, to help children, and to generally make the world a better place. And when we look at the example of Christ, he's an interesting character in regards to leadership because he was a wonderful leader, and yet he rejected power every time it was given to him. Every time. Remember when he was tempted in the desert and the devil kept trying to get him to use his power or claim his power? And every time he rejected it. And when he knew his time was close and people started coming to him, like the two brothers that came to him and said, "When you go, when you become the most powerful king in the land, we want to sit at your right-hand side," he refused. He refused to choose a successor. He refused to concentrate power by giving it all to one person, even though people asked. Instead, he gave it to a body of people that had to work together to make decisions. And the powers that he gave them were to heal and to minister, not to rule. And so we look at Belshazzar, who was born into power. He didn't earn it. He backed into it. He just happened to be born at the right place at the right time. And so when he had all of this power thrown upon him, thousands of conquered cities, enormous amounts of land, vast amounts of money, he was given the most powerful position on the entire planet. He didn't earn it. He didn't learn about it. He didn't honor and acknowledge it. He simply used it. Used it to exploit. Used it to shame. And when you look at the people that lived in his kingdom, we have to recognize that when people have enormous amounts of power, they have an enormous sacred trust. When we have more power than another individual, like when we're parents and we have children, we have a sacred trust that we will not use our power irresponsibly, that we will use it to help and to nurture and to heal. When we're teachers, we have that same power. When we are elected leaders, we have that same power. And when Belshazzar was in power, I want to just tell you a little bit about how the Babylonians worked and how the Assyrians worked, how they were able to conquer lands. They had a modus operandi that was elegant and extremely effective. When they conquered a city, what they usually did was they would besiege the city. They would set up siege works so that nobody could get in and out. And then they would wait the people out until they ran low on food and water, until the population was too weak to defend itself and was angry at their leaders for not protecting them. And then when the people couldn't fight back, they would attack, and then they would win. They generally won. I think they won pretty much every battle they ever fought. They conquered every city they went after. And then they would take half of the population and they would move them someplace else and plunk them down into another city that had just been conquered probably a few weeks or months prior and get them set up there. A lot of the men they would take to the army, the women and the children, they would move. And so by the time Belshazzar came to power, almost every single city was composed of refugees, people who were new to town, didn't speak the language, didn't know any of their neighbors, were moving into the houses of people whose friends used to live there, so they were automatically seen as enemies. And so at that point, they were completely dependent upon the Babylonian government for their sustenance, for their jobs, for their food, for their shelter, and for their lives. It was amazing how well this worked to be able to conquer lands very, very quickly and to keep the population from revolting very, very effectively. The Assyrians perfected the technique. The Babylonians followed right in their footsteps, and this went on for about 800 years. So by the time Belshazzar comes into town as the new king, he is ruling over exiled peoples, refugees, widows, orphans, aliens, and sojourners. That is the population of the Empire of Babylon. And so he has an enormous sacred trust. So I would like to tell you a little bit about my story. Not sure if you know that much about Spider-Man. But Spider-Man backed into power very much like Belshazzar did. I was very young when I became Spider-Man. I was a normal high school kid. I was a school photographer. I was kind of a geek. I had some friends, but not too many. I was an orphan. My parents had died. I was living with my aunt and my uncle Ben and my aunt May. Perhaps you've heard of them. And all of a sudden, one day, I was bit by this spider. We were on a little school field trip. There was a spider. Some scientists had been tinkering with radioactivity, and this spider had absorbed an enormous amount of it and bit me as it died. Bit me. And all of a sudden, the next morning, I woke up, and I had superpowers. I didn't earn these. I didn't fight for them. I didn't learn about them. I was completely unprepared for them. And my life wasn't so great. So I could have used these powers to do really, really mean things. I could have used them to get a lot of attention, to become very powerful, to get back at the bullies that had picked on me, to go after the people that had hurt my parents, to try and get the girl at school that I had a crush on to like me. I could have done any number of those things. And I wanted to. I really, really did. Because it feels good to feel powerful when you have been powerless for a long time. But fortunately, my Uncle Ben told me something really important before he died. Really important. What he said was, always remember that with great power comes great responsibility. And I think when he said that, he was talking exactly about the sacred trust that we see again and again and again in the Bible, that when you have enormous amounts of power, with it comes a sacred trust to use it only for good for the people that have less, to use it to help the most vulnerable, the widows, the orphans, the refugees, the aliens, the sojourners. We have a sacred trust. And so fortunately, because I like my Uncle Ben and he was a good person that took care of me, I heard his words and I took them to heart, and I've tried to live the rest of my life doing only good with my superpowers, not flaunting them, not exploiting them. And so far, it's been going okay. It's been going okay. So what I think is interesting is that right now we're looking at election season where we have to look at leadership and we have to elect leaders. We have to evaluate leaders. And I think it's interesting that at this time in our lives, right now, right here, as Christians in the United States, we are living in the most powerful empire on the planet. You realize that? We're living in the most powerful empire on the planet. And we are in the dominant culture. Our leaders are some of the most powerful people in the world, and we benefit from that. And just by being who we are, we have an enormous amount of power because we have more power and more privilege than other people in our country and other people in other countries. And so when we elect our leaders, we have a sacred trust. They have a sacred trust with the rest of the planet, with all the other people that we may not know, that we may not see, whose names we may never hear. But whether we want it or not, power has been thrust upon us. And so we need to acknowledge it and recognize it and remember what my Uncle Ben said, that with great power comes great responsibility. And so we get to decide what we're going to do with that. And at the same time, we need to recognize that in some strange twist of fate, we are all refugees in this country, are we not? We are all refugees. If we're not direct refugees, our parents or our grandparents were. How many people here live in a different city than the city they were born in? How many people go to a different church than the church that they grew up in? How many people live in a different country or than they were born in or that their parents were born in? Yeah. We are a country of refugees, and we are a country of great power and great privilege. Great power and great privilege. And so we get to decide, are we going to be the Mene, the Tekel, or the Perez? Are we going to be the Mina, the Shekel, or the Parson? Are we going to be the gold leadership, the good, responsible leadership? Are we going to be the not-so-good leadership, or are we going to be the type that doesn't mix well with others and that causes division between us and our brethren around the world? Because the Bible is very clear again and again and again. It says that we are measured not by our power, but how we use it. How we use it. We are measured as a society and as a community by how we treat the widow and the orphan, by how we treat the refugee, the alien, and the sojourner. And so I would encourage you to remember my Uncle Ben's motto. And I feel my spidey sense tingling. I sense trouble in a nearby city. I'm going to have to leave in just a moment. But I want you to remember what he said, with great power, whether we like it or not, whether we acknowledge it or not, whether we want it or not, whether we earned it or backed into it, whether it was thrust upon us, whether we try to reject it or not, with great power comes great responsibility. Can I get an amen to that?
Amen.